This is Ralph and Tom.
Atomic batteries compound. Turbine speed.
Roger. Ready to move on.
Live. After our complete top 40 countdown. 40, 39, new at 38, back in at 37, 36. Back up 4 at 35, 34, 33, down 9, down 10 at 32, down 1 at 31. Number 30, 29, 28, 27, 26, 25, 24, 23 is a non-mover. Up 4 at 22 at 21. Number 20 is 19, 18, 17, it's up a place. 16, down 15 is also up 3 at 14, back up 3 at 13, climbing 3 at 12. And number 11 is a non-mover. And now the top 10. 9, 8, slipping 6,
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2,
the number one song,
based purely on nothing,
bigger than nothing,
lolly,
and nothing else.
So, hallo, hier ist, So, hallo, hier ist Felicia Herrschaft heute mit einer Sendung, wo ich dachte, am besten fangen wir mit Musik an. Und zwar hören wir im Hintergrund DJ Spooky Paul D. Miller. Und zwar war Paul D. Miller jetzt in München bei der Utopia Station. Und diese CD hier, Subliminal Kid Rhythm Science in the 21st Century. werden wir gleich mal näher besprechen. Zumindest waren die Konzerte da sehr beeindruckend. Und war es das mit dem Thema heute der arabischen Welt, als auch der Utopia Station und auch von den Kriegen zu tun hat, werde ich dann gleich erklären.
Now, to begin with, here are some expressions you will use most often.
Okay, Paul D. Miller, DJ Spooky. Today you started your conversation in the way that you were eating an apple. No, talking on social sculptures, and how is it possible to come from the hip hop culture into this kind of social sculpture thinking?
Well, to me, a lot of what's going on with the art world right now is you have to understand the kind of conceptual issues around how people live in networks. And so what Utopia Station is doing is kind of thinking about the possibility of another world, almost. You know, it's like an art piece where you're in a bubble that's a, you know, like an autonomous space. What I'm doing with my music is thinking about it as fragments and shareware, you know, being able to exchange with people. And so what I presented the other night was I was working with these German jazz musicians, sampling them. They were playing, and I was taking the digital version of that and cutting it and doing things and sending it back. So you were hearing these different streams of fragments of jazz. And I always think of jazz as kind of a conversation, improvisation. And, you know, so I was doing a digital version of what I think of as jazz. So, so today when I was talking, that's another project I'm doing with Chuck D. He's rhyming and sending his words over the internet. And I sample that and then make music around it.
You sample what he is doing on the internet?
Yeah, he sent me a whole bunch of files of his voice.
Okay, and how would you say, because Jack D as a communication designer is really thinking very specific on the political situation of the black African culture in
I think he's even more about humanism. I think Chuck D is...
Humanism.
Yeah, it's not...
Universal quotes in what he's doing in music. But somehow, hip-hop culture is more a social process coming, developing an expressive new voice. What? Where's the relation between the people from the streets getting a new expressive and situated knowledge from the streets and this kind of aesthetic discourse on communication and art and...
Right. Well, this is why, for me, music is always part of how I actually think of it as a vocabulary that everyone speaks. You know, you can understand music, doesn't matter if you're Dutch, German, French, Spanish, whatever. You hear rhythms, the rhythm has a certain cadence and pattern, and I think that that's an important thing to think about. I have my book that just came out, it's called Rhythm Science, and I explore these kinds of ideas. It's basically thinking about making art out of patterns of culture. So it doesn't matter if it's the street or the academy or in outer space or on the internet. It's the patterns of meaning that you pull together these fragments that gives it life. So to me, it's not about a distinction between the class of people or the high or low, because networks go through every culture and they are able to pull people together from radically different backgrounds, which is what, and again, that's what this utopian station is going on. There's all these different people. It's very rare you would have Rim Koolhaas, Edward Glisson, and me as a DJ in the same building.
And how do you become an artist? I think you're more thinking in this art structures than in being a DJ, maybe.
No, a DJ, again, the whole idea is multiplicity. I operate in multiple theaters. Music is one scene, the art world's one scene, the literary scene is one scene, and I move between all of them. So I DJ in clubs too all the time, no problem. I do art projects, no problem. It means I'm working a lot. But it's something I find gratifying, and it makes, if I was just doing one thing or just in one scene, I'd be really bored.
Yeah. And have you read this book from Kodwo Ejun?
He's a friend of mine.
Okay. What do you think on this idea of these slavery, memory, and thinking on the sea, this coming up of the music out of the sea because of this experience of the slavery in the 18th and 19th century?
Yeah, Kodwo's a great guy. He's an old friend of mine. And I think it's an important step to think about these ideas of, in a literary context, and music is a different kind of literature. So what him and me are talking about is a kind of notion of media literacy, and sampling is playing with these kind of memories and how you remember fragments of the media and the recordings around you. What Kodwo is talking about with his idea of the Black Atlantic or the Black experience of the migration is how people carried these patterns with them from Africa to the New World, and how they influenced electronic music and DJ culture. I'm talking about more in my book, Rhythm Science, how these cultures of rhythm and electronic music have absorbed a lot of the avant-garde from the last century. You know, the futurists, the surrealists, even notions of modular architecture. If you think about rhythms as structure, boom, 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 boom. You can take anything and create a pattern out of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what do you think these conversations in the Utopia stations, do you think this fit together, having these conversations and these sculptures? Because in your concert you said that music can be a sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we need a sculpture, the thinking of on sculptures, if we are in social processes? Where's the need for it? What is the need for it?
I think it gives people a sense of context. You know, there's a very intriguing tension between content and context. You know, and so what I'm doing is creating a bridge between thinking about music not just as a surface, but something that you're in a structure, you're in it, you know, in every level, every angle. And that's why we had me away from everyone, and I was had each musician sending me a stream, and I was like creating and collaging and cutting it and then sending it back out to the speakers. So It's a sculpture, but of networks, you know, me being a node or a link, them being a node, you know, and a link connecting it. It's, sculpture is perhaps a little bit of an old word right now, you know. Maybe the more 21st century way to think of it is networks.
Mm-hmm. And you saw this Raymond Kohlhaas exhibition. Mm-hmm. What do you think is a new picture of Europe?
I think it's really important that he, as an architect, has created a, again, another tension between context and content. In fact, his book is called Content, which is funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all collage and, you know, the same kind of thing. But it's extremely rare that you would have such a visionary force going on in architecture. Usually they try and become very specific and, you know, and he's got a very good vision of so much of what's going on. I really enjoy the show.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
This is Ralph and Tom. This is Ralph and Tom.
Atomic batteries abound.
So. Jetzt, nachdem DJ Spooky darüber gesprochen hat, wie wir uns eine bessere Welt vorstellen können, wie das Musik eine andere Form der Literatur ist und inwiefern die Ausstellung, die von Rehm Kohlhaas jetzt in München eröffnet wurde, nämlich ein anderes Bild Europas zeigt, denke ich, nehmen wir als ersten Punkt, um heute zu beginnen und zum Schluss eben mit einer Lesung zu enden. Und in der Zwischenzeit wird es dann eben Ausschnitte geben, Auszüge, Interviews mit Iman Humaydan Yunis über das Buch Wilde Maulbeeren, eine Autorin aus Beirut, genauso. Und das ist die Verbindung eben dann zu Ethel Adnan im Herzen des Herzens eines anderen Landes. Sie verarbeitet in diesem Buch zum Schluss auch die Möglichkeit der Literatur während des Irakkrieges, und davor werde ich, um eigentlich genau diese Bedingungen zu erklären, was es heißt, sich in diesen Krisengebieten zu befinden, aus denen diese arabische Literatur derzeit kommt, Caroline Emkes Buch von den Kriegen vorstellen, in einem Gespräch mit ihr über die Briefe an Freunde. Und um die Utopia Station, die jetzt in München vor Ort gewesen ist, mit dieser Hoffnung auf eine bessere Welt einzufangen, jetzt eben dann zuerst das Bild Europas von Rehm Kohlhaas in einem wirklich kurzen Statement. Und dann die Frage, was ist eigentlich die Utopia Station? Um auf Frankfurt dann zu kommen, habe ich vor der Sendung ein Gespräch mit Martina Weinhardt aufgenommen, die über die Ausstellung 3 Minutes und Nahe Osten näher sprechen wird. Dies alles Annäherungen eigentlich für die Frage danach, wie können wir möglicherweise die Bedingungen des Abwesenden besser verstehen. Da gibt es ein Buch von Taha Ben-Jelloun, Das Gebet der Abwesenheit an die Abwesenden. Und das ist genau dann mir in die Hände gefallen auf der Buchmesse, nachdem ich von Derridas Tod erfahren habe und ähnlich wie Ethel Adnan über einer Schläf jetzt gesagt hat, er wird uns fehlen, bleibt eigentlich nur zu sagen, Derrida wird uns fehlen. Und da Derrida einer der Denker Europas gewesen ist, eines Europas mit jeweils ankommenden Demokratien, ist genau diese Frage der Abwesenheit eigentlich etwas, das auch eine Verbindung herstellt zur Literatur in der arabischen Welt. Und das werden wir genau in dem Gespräch mit Iman Humaydan Yunis versuchen zu klären. Genauso Krieg als der Ausdruck der stummen Gewalt, als der Ausdruck dessen, dass Krieg einfach die Bedingung ist, war kills, that is all it does. Ist der Krieg immer die Verbindung dazu, dass wir da unter, nicht nur unter Abwesenheit, sondern genau unter der Erfahrung des nicht Erklärbaren stehen. Und genau das bespricht Caroline Ehmke eben in Bezug darauf, was in den Flüchtlingslagern passiert, dass sie dort erfährt, Zeugin zu sein, nämlich Zeugin für die Menschen, die dort erfahren, dass sie eigentlich nicht mehr, dass sie in dem, wie sie sie als Zeugin wahrnehmen, endlich jemand treffen, der ihr Unrecht sozusagen als Unrecht auch wahrnimmt und erkennt. Und das ist dann immerhin die Anwesenheit des anderen, das genau dies ermöglicht.
Now that you know the sounds that all the stretches make, you can put them together to make words. Put the words together to make sentences, and put lots of sentences together to make paragraphs. But you may need a little practice, so try it. All you need is a turntable.
For those unfamiliar with modern stereo terminology, a turntable is a mechanical device that contains both a rotating disc and a needle.
Your turntable must move the surface of the disc past the
control
stylus at a constant rate of speed.
Excuse me. I do not understand.
Speak clearly so you can understand. Put words together.
Can I speak in English?
Yeah.
Okay.
What kind of new picture of Europe will you is developed in this exhibition?
Well, it's not really a new picture, but it is an explicit picture. In the past 50 years, we have seen the construction of the European Union, but although that process has been very successful in terms of transforming Europe, it has been kind of largely hidden and very discreet. And although initially that worked very well, I think that part of the current dissatisfaction with Europe and with its apparent overdose of regulation and its bureaucracy, it has to do with the fact that there is no explicit narrative and no explicit story and no explicit manifesto of Europe. And so what we try to do in this project is to really describe the history of Europe of the past 50 years, show how heroic and radical the whole effort has been, how it is beginning to have an enormous effect on the world in terms of offering an alternative way of exercising power, not by guns or arms, but by regulations.
Yeah.
And where we're also trying to develop a number of scenarios into the future, and Turkey, the connection with Turkey is only one fragment of such a scenario of what the ultimate effect of Europe could be. So basically, there's nothing new about it, but all we're doing is to make it visible.
Yeah. So why is it important for this new picture of Europe to have a flag with the different identities?
It's not so much important that it's not a new flag, but it's a different way of representing Europe. Basically, many of the nations that are joining Europe have a fear that by joining so, and many of the inhabitants of Europe have a fear that by joining Europe their own identity is taken away, and that somehow the whole situation becomes more homogeneous. And what we wanted to show is that you can be European and still entirely retain your own character. And that instead of taking something away, the idea of being European kind of gives you an additional space to define your own identity. So it is basically a reassurance that nothing is taken away, and that you can be and remain yourself, so to speak.
You present the European Union as a result, this kind of picture, and that's maybe the connection to the African Union?
No, but what we're saying is that the idea of unifying a number of different countries in a new way and connecting them through a kind of sharing regulations and agreeing about regulations, that is an inspiring model, and that, for instance, the African Union is a direct outcome of that inspiration, and is actually a kind of very important and hopeful sign for Africa.
In this moment.
Yes, but Europe was powerless too, and that is the beauty of this history.
Yeah.
It started in a very improvised way. It was a constant improvisation.
Yeah.
It had many reversals, but still it achieved. So now I go there.
Raum, was passiert dann in dem dritten Raum?
Der dritte Raum ist eigentlich das gleiche, weil das dann geht das erste Panorama durch mit der Geschichte, und das ändert so mit dem Madrid-Bombing der Geschichte Europas, und der fängt die Geschichte des Europäischen Union an. So, also die zwei Seitenraume, das sind die zwei Panoramas gegenübergestellt, und im Mittelraum sind die 25 Länder.
Ja.
Und das ist...
Okay. Und dann wird ja auch eine neue Fahne entworfen von AMO, und die enthält ja jetzt tatsächlich eine Bildhaftigkeit, eigentlich auch nationale Identitäten.
Ja, das war eine Fahne, die das Idee des Diversitäts-Europas entspricht,
ja.
Aber trotzdem eine Fahne ist, die das gleich und direkt zeigt. Und das ist auch eine Fahne, die geändert würde, wenn neue Mitglieder dazu kommen. Und
dann kann das ergänzt werden mit den jeweiligen Farben.
Genau, und das ist
Nation.
Auch um das Idee zu entkraften, dass Europa nur das einzelne Blau ist.
Okay, es ist nicht das einzelne Blau. Junger Mann. Es ist nicht das einzelne Blau mehr, aber es ist doch eine Form der neuen Identität Europas.
Ja. Aber eine Identität, die nicht enthält, dass dass die nationale Identität aufgegeben muss.
Aufgegeben werden muss.
Werden muss, was
genau.
Offen die Angst ist, die manche Leute. So, wir haben versucht, eine Art von Symbol zu entwerfen, die diese Angst widerspricht.
Ja. So, und das war jetzt zuerst Rehm Koolhaas und dann sein Mitarbeiter von AMO, Jens Hultqvist oder so ähnlich. Auf jeden Fall, diese Ausstellung, das Bild Europas, ist nun im Haus der Kunst in München zu sehen. Und es ist wirklich sehr spannend, dass das Büro von Rehm Koolhaas sogar dazu aufgefordert wurde, eine neue Flagge zu entwerfen. Und aus dieser Idee dieser neuen Flagge ist tatsächlich auch eine historische Aufarbeitung und Collagenform der jeweiligen Identitäten dieser Ausstellung entstanden, die dieses Bild Europas zeigen soll. Also, wie gesagt, das Bild Europas jetzt in München. Wir werden jetzt noch ein Interview aus München hören, und zwar im Rahmen der Utopia Station, kuratiert von Hans-Ulrich Obrist, Rikriti Ramanija und Molly Nesbitt. Und in dem Rahmen habe ich mit Liam Gillick gesprochen, der hier in Frankfurt auch nicht sehr unbekannt sein dürfte, als jemand, der auch das Logo für den Kunstverein hier entworfen hat. Und das werden wir jetzt sofort hören und dann übergehen und Martina Weinhardt zur Ausstellung 3 Minutes und Nahe Osten näher in Frankfurt hören. Okay, Liam Gillick. First question. You are part of Utopia Station with this work on display for actual information to the Utopia events. So what is the reason for you to... What are the reasons for this work in relation to Utopia Station?
At the beginning of this project, I had no interest whatsoever in proposing any artwork that I would normally work on. And it's very important to understand that the interventions I've made within the structure of Utopia Station, both in Venice last year and now here, I do not view them as my artwork. There are a number of reasons for that. One of them is I just didn't want to get involved in a process of this kind of post-Duchampian kind of nomination of things as art. I wanted to look at this thing as a practical exercise for discussion and so on. So I at all times looked for quite basic requirements and needs, and when having identified them, tried to deal with them. So in Venice I proposed the seating and a seating design that could work both as an intimate circle, but also one could sit facing outwards and use the same seating for much larger groups. And, you know, there was always a problem around the opening days in Venice last year, which is that I realized that my practical, pragmatic, withdrawn, suppressed, non-art, useful offering had been what you could say, it's not really a word in English, but you could say arted, that I'd found suddenly my chairs had become seating units, 2003, Liam Gillick, on a kind of work list. And throughout this process, I've had big arguments about how to contribute something that's merely a kind of part of the framework of the project without understanding that as an artwork. It's really, you know, so same here with these blackboard or chalkboard areas. They're really... They're really something that I've put in front of the organizers of the project to allow them to have more tools with which they can express the content of what they're doing. And you know, this isn't really... It's very close to things I might do in other contexts, but here it should not be understood as an artwork by Liam Gillick. This is a moment of withdrawal. It's a moment of skepticism for me. It's not a moment to be reasserting my creative potential. It's merely... It's an attempt to be involved in the project, yet withdrawing at the same time.
And is this display with black stripes on the wall, is this a kind of solution for the architecture here in the Haus der Kunst in relation to the tower of Rigrid Tiramanija?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that to a certain extent I was looking for very easy to achieve, quite practical solutions that could really be, in a way, kind of test the rhetoric, if you like, of the project, because there's a claim that the project is about communication and discussion, and the place forms an improvised site for this to take place. Yet I wonder how transparent some of this discussion and this sense of this kind of coming together really is. So I wanted to kind of create a space within the design of the project that could reveal a lack, if that might be the case. It could reveal the absence of something, because, you know, it's inherently easy to alter and add and change and modify and put forward information on these chalkboards, which should allow them to become a very urgent and very clear form of telling people what's happening within the content of the show at any point. But of course, what happens is they also reveal... They're very revealing, so of course they also reveal a lack of that, maybe. So, again, a bit like the the battle in Venice for the nomination of the work, of saying, is it an artwork by Liam Gillick or is it just a chair? Here, that mentality is extended a little further to the question of how much is this really a talking forum? How much is the printed list of the contributors, the real list of the contributors, and to give someone the chance to communicate and update that information in real time is both a positive thing, but it can also reveal the lack of the reality matching the rhetoric. And with this Utopia project, I'm interested often to sort of, to use this kind of psychobabble terms, to kind of root it back in the point of the project, or to sometimes just unstabilize it, or to sometimes reassert my thinking, which is that this concept of utopia is usually often used historically as an accusation in the face of the temporary failure of progressive thinking by being, from my perspective, interested in simple things like seating that works, ways that you can truly communicate. That reflects my interest in what you could call applied utopia, where I'm much more interested in what you can do, not this constant over the rainbow feeling. Do you see what I mean? So some of this is to do with authorship questions, some of it's to do with ego collapse, and some of it's to do with my my interest in concrete attempts to really do something, and sometimes those gestures are inherently not suppressed, but they're inherently straightforward, I think.
Yeah.
You know.
And that Utopia station is on the way to Porto Alegre. What has this to do with your understanding of Utopia to be on the way?
Well, I wrote a book that came out in 2002 called Literally No Place. And literally no place is one way of understanding the word utopia. And my decision to call the book Literally No Place was as a deliberate avoidance of the use of the word utopia. And within that text, I was trying to look at the way to understand the influence of the history, the recent modern history of American attempts to maintain a form of communality and communal thinking in the culture, but avoid the main, you could say, the main narrative of the time, which would be a kind of Marxist thinking. And following 1911, which is the last time the socialists had any presence in the American politics, you have a complete abandonment of analysis and use of the tools with which the rest of the world have used to try to understand how you can remake communal situations. Mm. However, you still have attempts to make communal situations. So you have So my interest in the book was very much to look at these kind of rather subtle and rather kind of hard to define issues, rather than looking at this grander question of utopia. I'm skeptical about the idea of Puerto Alegre, and I've expressed that very clearly to the co-curators of the project. I've expressed extreme concern that the form that this kind of collaborative project has taken in Venice and also now here in Munich, if you bring that improvised structuring, which is very much geared towards posters, flyers, things that can be produced cheaply, things that can leave a trace, that can indicate positive feelings towards the project by artists without too much involvement. If we bring that kind of aesthetic to an environment which is that aesthetic, the World Social Forum, it is based on flyers and rhetoric and statements and discussion and so on, that I'm not convinced that that's the most productive way a group of artists can be there. However, what's important to remember is in Mumbai, they did use the name of artists, the names of artists, to nominate certain areas in the actual physical stretch. There was a Joseph Beuys promenade, and there was maybe a Rauschenberg plaza, and they used art in a way as this kind of, with the idea that it has this ameliorating quality in the society, that it's one of the ways we reconnect and we de-alienate from the society, and also that it's an acceptable legacy of internationalism somehow, that it's one of the few areas where maybe they could express a kind of commonality through art. Now, from my understanding of what's interesting and the potential of creative practice is that this illusion of internationalism is merely an illusion. It's as difficult and problematic as any forms of globalization. So I think what happened is that there was a desire on the part of Molly Nesbitt, Hansa Kobrist, and Rickert to at least offer an alternative to just using the names of famous socially conscious artists as roots within the World Social Forum, and instead of that, to actually try to bring active, functional, contemporary artists of many ages to the place to see what will happen, to see what will be determined. From my perspective, I think that this is an interesting curatorial conceit, but I'm not convinced how interesting it is for a group of artists who, frankly, are primarily from Europe and North America to go and become another pressure group, as it were. It's a very difficult thing, or to assume the role of a deeply concerned pressure group. I think it's possible that the way to go would be either to go there to listen, to become informed, which will inherently change our work, to withdraw from production, as it were. Another option is to do what we normally do, which is we think at least that we have a critical engagement with the society. Some of that critical engagement is more obvious and apparent in some people than in others. However, that is what we do. We go to institutions, and Puerto Alegre is a kind of institution. We critique the structure, we work with it, we play off it, we deal with it. And I think this could be a very, to go to Puerto Alegre without conditions could be very interesting, rather than to have a nominated spot within it. No one would ever accept this with a contemporary Biennale or a contemporary, one would always question this kind of territorializing within a structure. So, you know, while I understand the desire to go and take part, I mean, one goes to take part in lots of events, so why not Puerto Alegre? I'm concerned that as the first moment, as the first presence, artistic presence in a serious way in something like this, we have a really big obligation to think about whether or not they're really... I'm not convinced that it's necessarily true that there ought to be people there making what we think of as kind of contemporary art. I'm not convinced that every situation requires the particular relativism of contemporary art. I think sometimes, you know, it really needs thinking through. So, for me, it's very difficult, and I've argued quite strongly that we suspend our engagement with that, and we think very hard before we really do something like this.
Yeah, if you have as an artist this critical engagement, I would like to know where are the difference in how artists use political discourse and how political activists use artists, concepts from artists for their work. The question would be, where's the difference? If how will you activate political engagement and this in relation of sharing common grounds, maybe?
Yes, exactly, and I think it'd be very easy to do something that appears to do it very superficially, but in fact doesn't do it in any effective real way. I'm very interested in working as an artist to look at to see if it's possible to identify these tiny cracks and fissures that open up between what we think of as kind of established social structures, and to occupy those territories and open them up and make them appear to be enormous plateaus of that can then be analyzed and taken over and reclaimed in many cases. And this for me is very interesting. To go and merely declare is a problem similar to the classic problems around conceptual art, where to a certain extent one field of conceptual art became merely the nomination of things in the world, you know, like the kind of the nominating of everything, you know, and the sort of, and by that somehow the idea would be that it becomes better, or it becomes taken over, or it becomes better understood. I'm not convinced. It just gets renamed, which doesn't necessarily change anything. I'm concerned that the thing can become a kind of hollow rhetoric. That, of course, to a certain extent, we're, you know, right-thinking people are all on the same side of the barricade, but it's not necessarily the point to be merely looking at, desperately looking for a more and more generalized statement, or in a postmodern condition, a more and more super subjective sequence of statements that can become a generalized matrix of a statement. That I'm not always convinced this could be the best way to work. I think the obligation of the artist is to work in parallel to these things, to work in parallel and to remain not the classic model of the avant-gardist outsider necessarily, but to keep shifting the terms of engagement. You know, the question being, for example, with this exhibition structure here, is it documentary or fiction? Is it a film in real time, or is it just some pictures and some objects? You know, these kind of questions that surround this project, which can be understood as quite complicated questions, I think the artist's relationship to a structure like Puerto Alegre has to be equally complicated. It's not a moment to kind of be patronizing and be simple and say, we're right behind you or something like this. It's a moment to continue the critical process. That's the obligation. And no, it's not a utopia. It's a real, concrete struggle where you don't have to be radicalized to think about this, but, you know, it's about rich people getting richer and the poor people getting poorer and the distribution of wealth and all these things that just don't work. So, you know, the going to Puerto Alegre is much less complicated in a way than going to the Haus der Kunst. But what you do there and how you engage yourself, you have to be really careful that you don't just image it and create like a kind of flow of relativistic images that can then be consumed in their own way, and you don't destroy the directness of the event, and you don't destroy the seriousness of the discourse by giving it, by re-picturing it in a way. So if you could talk about some conceptual art renominating things and possessing them in a greedy way by renaming everything, I think one also has to be careful one doesn't just re-image everything, re-image every urgent political process, every urgent desire, every urgent inequality, that you don't just re-image it as an artist in a way that renders it doesn't render it clearer, it just renders it part of like an excess of images, which we have to be really careful about it. Puerto Alegre does not produce many images that are not authored by the people who are directly concerned with the event they're dealing with. It's mainly either talking and discussion in a non-specific environment, or it's like people directly, clearly expressing a need, a lack, desire, something like that. And introducing the relativism of the art context to that is potentially very dangerous, because you start the normal deconstructive processes of postmodernism in terms of aesthetics may well have a very destructive... If you start to doubt, is this person really dying of lack of water, or is this a commentary upon the idea of someone dying for lack of water? There are these cut-off points where morally and ethically you have to say, is complicating the message, making it more sophisticated and more serious and more profound, or is it actually dangerously complicating the message? You see what I mean? And then making it less clear.
In and out of town, puts on the best of round, with the crazy sound. Get your freak on.
Steady, are you ready? What's going on? Steady, are you ready?
Are you ready? Ja, nach diesem Gespräch mit Liam Gillig über die Utopia Station in München im Haus der Kunst, die sich auf den Weg macht nach Porto Alegre in Brasilien zum World Social Forum, kann man vielleicht noch darauf hinweisen, jetzt dieses Wochenende, 15. bis 18. ist das Europäische Social Forum in London, und da wäre es vielleicht auch spannend, noch dazu zu berichten, was dort passieren wird. Aber interessant ist tatsächlich die Fragen, die Liam Gillig als Künstler gestellt hat. Was ist eigentlich dann gerade bei einem Projekt, Ausstellungsprojekt wie der Utopia Station, das Dokumentarische oder das die Fiktion, und wie kann man eigentlich einen kritischen Prozess aufrechterhalten, gerade wenn man sich innerhalb postmoderner ästhetischer Diskurse befindet, damit diese eben nicht auf bestimmte Fragen hereinfallen oder genau diesen kritischen Prozess unterbrechen, gerade wenn es darum geht, wer ist eigentlich das Subjekt, das zum Beispiel leidet. Wir werden jetzt das Interview mit Martina Weinhardt hören, Kuratorin hier in der Schirn in Frankfurt, über eben die Ausstellung Nahe Osten näher. Also es heißt eigentlich ein Projekt im öffentlichen Raum. Und zwar wurde eben im Rahmen des Ehrengastauftritts der arabischen Welt wurden die verschiedenen Buslinien hier mit Bildern, Statements von Kader, Atia, Munir, Fatmi, Hasan Khan und Rosalind Nashahibi bestückt, und darüber sprechen wir, und das ist dann der Übergang eigentlich zu den Autorinnen auf der im Rahmen der arabischen Welt sich präsentiert haben. So, hallo Martina Weinhardt. Hallo?
Hallo, ja.
Ah, okay, ich wollte jetzt nur mal kurz testen. Also jetzt, die Schirn hat im Rahmen der arabischen Welt auf der Buchmesse der Gastregion eine Ausstellung im öffentlichen Raum realisiert, Nahe Osten näher.
Ja.
Das heißt, was genau ist im Rahmen dieser Ausstellung in dem Sinne zu sehen?
Sehen sind vier Beiträge von vier Künstlern, die eines gemeinsam haben, dass sie nämlich sozusagen mit einem Bein in der arabischen Welt und mit dem anderen Bein im Westen stehen. Die haben Beiträge für dieses Projekt eingereicht, die genau dieses Thema der Identität in zwei verschiedenen Kulturen, in zwei verschiedenen Sprachen thematisieren.
Das heißt, da werden eben Statements von Kader Atia, Munir Fatmi, Hasan Khan und Rosalind Nashahibi gezeigt auf den Bussen, und das sind normalerweise großformatige Werbeflächen auf 8 Bussen, und was sind das in dem Sinne für Motive?
Also alle Künstler sind auf aus dem Bereich Foto bzw. Video und aus diesen Medien wurden Images, wenn man so will, gewählt, die sehr komprimiert dieses Thema bearbeiten. Also zum Beispiel Munir Fatmi hat zwei Selbstporträts für dieses Projekt erstellt, die ihn einmal angezogen und einmal mit nacktem Oberkörper zeigen, und er hat sich auf diesen Selbstporträts selber editiert, und zwar hat er seinen Namen auf die Brust beschrieben, auf einmal in arabischer Schrift und einmal in lateinischer Schrift, also ganz simpel diese doppelte Identität thematisiert, ganz auf den Punkt gebracht. Dann haben wir eine Arbeit von Rosalind Nashashibi, einer Videokünstlerin aus London, die irisch-palästinensischer Herkunft ist, und sie hat auch eine ganz simple Metapher gewählt, nämlich das Essen. Sie zeigt einmal eine arabische Familie in Palästina beim abendlichen Essen während des Ramadans und gleichzeitig eine Speisung der Heilsarmee in Schottland. Dann haben wir noch zwei Motive von Kader Atia. Das ist ein Künstler, der in Paris lebt, und der hat eine Fotoserie, die heißt Correspondance, wo er Bezug nimmt auf Fotos, die eine ganz wichtige Rolle spielen bei Familien, die eben weit entfernt leben und getrennt sind und diese Fotos als Kommunikationsmittel nehmen. Hasan Khan, der letzte Künstler, hat in seinem Beitrag das Porträt eines arabischen Mannes, eines dezidiert arabischen Mannes gewählt, um sozusagen die Angst vor dem Exotischen, vor dem Fremden, durch dieses Zurückstarren, was dieses Porträt macht, zu thematisieren und in unseren Stadtraum zu bringen. Das sind die Projekte, die auf den Bussen zu sehen sind.
Ja, und die Verkehrsgesellschaft, also die Busse zur Verfügung stellt, war sich ja erst nicht sicher, welche Linien dann bestückt werden mit den Bildern.
Ja.
Hat sich das jetzt in der Zwischenzeit dann geklärt, welche Linien sozusagen befahren werden mit den Bildern?
Das hat sich geklärt. Das sind vor allem die Innenstadtlinien, auch die Linien, die an der Messe vorbeifahren. Das ist die Linie 50 und die Linie 32. So, das ist auch wirklich von den Leuten zu sehen, wenn sie sich im Kontext auch der Buchmesse hier in Frankfurt aufhalten. Was ich jetzt aber nicht so entscheidend finde, weil ich finde, dass es ein Thema ist, in der Stadt immer virulent ist und dass das auch gerade in Bezirken eine Rolle spielt, die jetzt nicht gerade direkt an der Messe sind. Es ist ein Thema, das täglich vorhanden ist, nicht nur diese Woche der Buchmesse. Deswegen läuft das Projekt auch weiter bis zum 30. Oktober.
Ja, und du bist auch zuständig für eine weitere, also kuratorisch für eine weitere Ausstellung in der Schirn, die bis 2. Januar dort zu sehen ist, nämlich die Ausstellung 3 Minutes.
Mhm.
Um was geht es genau bei dieser Ausstellung, 3 Minutes?
Für 3 Minutes haben wir 10 Künstler beauftragt, die einen Kurzfilm von 3 Minuten Länge zu erstellen, indem es im weitesten Sinne um Verdichtung geht. Das heißt, Beiträge, die in irgendeiner Form eine kondensierte, komprimierte Erzählung oder komprimierte Informationen beinhalten. Dabei ging es jetzt nicht in erster Linie darum, diese Verdichtung als Erhöhung von Geschwindigkeit zu begreifen, das heißt Filmbeiträge zu bekommen, die einfach nur unglaublich schnell geschnitten sind, sondern die Ausstellung sollte eben unterschiedlichste Positionen auffächern, die auf ganz unterschiedliche Art und Weise mit dieser Struktur und mit diesem Thema umgehen.
Ja, dazu wurde ja das Architekturduo Asymptote aufgefordert, eben einen Raum zu entwickeln. Vielleicht könntest du zu diesem Raum noch etwas sagen, wie der mit diesen 3 Minutes in dem Sinne in Zusammenhang steht.
Der Raum war ganz wichtig für das Konzept dieser Ausstellung, da es ja um Konzentration ging. Und wir wollten eben auch einen Raum zur Verfügung stellen, dem Besucher, der ihm eine konzentrierte Rezeption dieser Beiträge gewährleistet. Das heißt, wir wollten ihn nicht, wie das normalerweise üblich ist, mit ganz unterschiedlichen Medieninseln konfrontieren, die er verlassen muss, eine neue wieder betreten muss, sich wieder neu orientieren, den Filmbeitrag nicht in voller Länge sehen, mittendrin hinein und hinausgehen, das kennen wir ja alle. Also hier sollte er eine kinoähnliche Situation vorfinden, wo er einmal den Raum betritt, die Filme in einer gewissen Abfolge sieht und dann entscheiden kann, ob er es nochmal sehen will oder wieder hinausgehen will. Und dafür hat Hani Rashid ein kinoartiges Setting entworfen, das eben genau diese konzentrierte Betrachtung gewährleistet.
Ja, also schwierig ist vielleicht, man muss natürlich dann im Vorfeld dieses Konzept sehr stark kommunizieren, 3 Minutes, sonst können nämlich die Betrachter, die Zuschauer ja das gleiche Problem haben, sie kommen da rein und wissen gar nicht, wo ein Film angefangen hat und wo der nächste, wo das Ganze aufhört.
Nicht ganz, weil dafür haben wir nämlich, haben wir natürlich Maßnahmen ergriffen, das heißt, wenn der Zuschauer das Treppenhaus betritt, findet er erstmal einen Screen vor dem Kinoraum. Dort sind gelistet die Filme in der Reihenfolge, wie sie laufen. Und der Film, der gerade läuft, ist gehighlightet und man sieht durch einen Verlauf auch, zu welchem Zeitpunkt der Projektion der Film sich gerade befindet. Das heißt, der Besucher kann entscheiden, ob er eben wirklich mitten im Film reingeht oder ob er einfach wartet, bis der nächste Film anfängt und dann zu diesem Zeitpunkt den Kinosaal betritt.
Ah ja, okay.
Haben wir kommuniziert.
Ja, und dann ist es ja auch möglich, dass man, wenn wenn man sich den Katalog in dem Sinne mitnimmt, dass da hat man dann sogar die DVD, auf der alle Filme enthalten sind. Das ist ja auch dann eigentlich spannend. Wie ist es zu dieser Idee gekommen, das so zu kombinieren?
Also wir haben eben diese Idee der konzentrierten Betrachtung einfach weitergesponnen und uns überlegt, was man da noch beitragen könnte. Oft ist es ja so, dass man diesen Film dann auch nochmal genauer anschauen möchte oder sich einen Film nochmal genauer anschauen möchte und andere vielleicht nicht. Und dabei ist es eben zu dieser Idee der DVD gekommen, wo man sich einmal den Ablauf der Ausstellung in einem Play-All-Modus anschauen kann und dann aber auch ganz gezielt einzelne Beiträge ansteuern kann und vielleicht den Film von André Sala 5-mal hintereinander nochmal anschauen möchte oder
sich Loops basteln in dem
Sinne. Ja.
Ja. Okay. Ja, wunderbar. Dann vielen Dank für das Gespräch.
Danke auch.
Ja.
Mind it, looking for a star like mine, you can't find it.